This is Steve Pellegrino. Hi, Steve.
How you doing, Larry? It's always great to be here. You have such a wonderful studio, and we were just looking at your new screen.
Yes,
with all the wonderful bells and whistles and controls that you have.
I could turn that off if it's going to
no,
you.
No, I love it. It's a great color.
I've learned when sometimes we are working with kids, and we'll display the lights so they can see their modulation, or so they can see their voice being recorded. And every now and then, like an 8-year-old will all of a sudden, he'd be talking fine and perfectly, and then he'll say something like, "Hello," and he's watching his.
I never thought of that. Sounds like fun.
Which is not necessarily the best radio in the world, but you do learn.
I just wanted to say, and I'm sorry that I couldn't perform today. I have a good story about an operation, and I think it's something. I tore my supraspinatus ligament, the one on top of your shoulder. So
I didn't even know there was
this shoulder, what it's called, the rotator cuff. There's many parts because, as you know, your shoulder can rotate, you know, three-dimensionally. It's not just like so there's all these things going on in there. And I happened to find a really good doctor, Dr. Lynn, who's I thank him so much. But what was wonderful is it was an outpatient, you know, a surgery. I went in at 6:30 in the morning and was out at 12:30. And I would say 3/4 of that time was spent in prep.
Sure.
And I'm so glad they asked me 100 times which shoulder it was.
I was going to ask you, my doctor, whose name is escaping me right now, I had to get my meniscus repaired my knee. And he not only did he ask me dozens of times which knee it was, but he eventually signed the knee. He like autographed my knee with his signature and date, so there would be like no mistaking it. And I guess all it takes is one, and then you've got all these procedures that emerge.
Yeah. And I had two sets of magic markers, and it was great. They kept asking me my name, asking my birth date, etc. Everybody, from the moment I walked into the surgical unit on the south side to the minute I walked out, were wonderful. And I've not been able to find any way I don't know how to send them a card. I keep thinking I'll just address it to the surgical unit on the 4th floor.
Some of them are listening.
Yeah, so, I hope. Because
so what hospital?
It was the south side has a surgical unit.
Oh, yeah.
It's near 18th Street.
Yeah, I've been there.
And it was like – it was great. Everybody I dealt with was wonderful. I asked questions. I even interviewed everybody, asked them how they got into it. I'm not a big fan of the operation, as you can tell. And so I tried to keep myself busy, you know, with other people's information. But and everyone said, you know, do your physical therapy. It's going to be rough. And you figured, how rough can it be? It's and I'm sure you had to come back from that kind of operation.
And I didn't do it. Now I don't regret it. And I'm a bad example.
Larry.
Well, actually, I was not as debilitated as I think the operation was relatively simple. And I did a lot of walking and things.
Well, that.
Some of the specific exercises. I have a very bad sense of not a bad sense of balance, but I'm not exactly a graceful, you know, I can't dance. I can't hold poses. You know, if I'm doing yoga, I can do tree pose for about a millisecond before I topple. And some of the physical therapy things just sort of had me like.
Well, as long as you're not limited now, my big problem is I'm at about 120 degrees, which is sort of about that much.
Yeah. Well, and a knee was really different.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
a shoulder.
Yeah. And you do so much with, you know, and one of the other problems, you know, my hands will swell up. So during the night, I'll wake up 3 or 4 times and have to squeeze and, you know, get it back going.
Why does that happen?
It's the whole thing. I mean, my God, when you think, I mean, one of the things they had to do was a nerve block. And this was very interesting. They took an ultrasound and then put it on a giant screen, and each of the nerves looked like, to me, about the size of my finger. So they had to put a needle in each of those nerves that made your arm numb. And so when I woke up for a day, I had no arm. I mean, it was not there.
How many? Are there a lot of them?
I don't know how many because I really wasn't paying that close.
But it's like bum, 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 bum.
I think three or four because
– wow.
And then, of course, you know, as you start to get feeling back, it's really weird because your middle finger must share a nerve. So half of it was awake and half of it was numb. And of course, they called me the next morning, 10 o'clock, and asked me, how's your hand coming? I said, okay, great. And as opposed to everybody asked me in all my checkups is what kind of pain. And it's like compared to the pain I had before, I have none. I have stiffness. And of course, when you do these exercises, as you know, there's pain involved.
Yeah.
And the big trick is how do I push and not, you know, destroy what they did? Because he basically had to sew tissue back to a bone and tissue. So you don't want to tear the operation, but, you know, you have to keep pushing forward. And this physical therapist I have, Sean, a great guy, great, good sense of humor. And, you know, and the greatest thing was my surgeon the other day said that PT stands for pain and torture.
I had a great one, too. And to me, it wasn't as much pain. I just could not do the tricks they wanted me to do.
Well, you know, I understand. I tell them, you know, a lot of these things you're asking me to do, I couldn't do when there was no, injury. It's like I don't think everybody is as flexible. You know, yoga sounds good on paper to me, but Tai Chi is more my speed.
It's the performance anxiety for me. You know,
that's so ironic because on the air you always sound so in charge and like on top of the whole thing.
It'd be the same thing if you wanted me to dance. You want me to do this with this foot, this with. I'll think about it so much that fall apart. But how did you injure yourself?
It was a sort of a gradual. I think over the last 2 years, I thought it was just I'm getting old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hang drywall and I plaster, which is almost always over my head, and it's a lot of heavy, hard work. And so it just was a matter of the straw just finally broke. You know, and of course, thank goodness my wife talked me into going to the doctor because I figured I'll just recover. But when I couldn't, touch my nose with my right hand, I figured maybe it was time. There was something else I wanted to bring up because I found it very interesting. One of the great things about as you get older, and you don't know this till you get older, is you're able to see a through line of a beginning to through something. And I can remember when you first started out with this show. And I found it interesting. I had noticed.
Glad you can.
Well, I can see that through line because you started out in a basement in Cable Place in Oakland.
In South Oakland.
And what's interesting is that you had a vision. And I love watching people follow that vision. And you can't see that when you're younger because So I get to see this incredible journey and know that at some point as a young person, you were so fascinated with the radio that you couldn't shake it. And so you had to do it. And it's just so great to see. I mean, when you see this studio compared to where you started, I mean, you're in Rockefeller Center here. And then when I hear you roll off all the different stations that your show's on and, you know, your website and everybody that works for you, it's an incredible transformation from this spark of listening to the radio and hearing people talk and having these sounds sent over the air.
Yeah.
And then have you actually grow up and be the guy who's sending those waves out over the airwaves.
Thank you. It is kind of neat. There are probably aspects of your childhood that are reflected in your life today.
Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's those things that, like, my problem was there were too many things that got me excited. So I never really did that because I can see in my son who's just from third grade on decide he's a musician. I could never decide one thing. So my whole bag is I'm going to do a lot of things pretty good together. And so that – because I just remember as a kid, in junior high, we went to the theater in Oakland. I can't remember the name.
There's the Studio Theater.
The one that Point Park has now.
The Playhouse. Over on Craft Street.
Right, yeah. And I saw a performance of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. And Puck was dressed in a bodysuit, putting money in a jukebox. There was a revolving stage and this incredible – and the men were playing women. And I was like, this is it.
Yeah.
I was totally blown away. And it was so interesting because when I met Ron Lindblom, who is the head of the theater department there, there was a picture of that performance on his wall. Because, you know, sometimes you think, well, maybe I'm exaggerating what I saw, you know, because that was a long time ago. And
no, there it is. I saw Leonard Nimoy in Twelfth Night at the what was then the Pittsburgh Public Theater, what is now the New Hazlett Theater.
Oh, wow.
And I think I was in eighth grade. And, you know, those theater field trips are really important. I can remember that like
yeah.
It was yesterday. He played Malvolio, I think. And it was fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I also saw The Odd Couple with Alan Alda's father.
Robert Alda.
Yeah. And, you know, it just – there's just – yeah, these field trips that – they take are really important because we would always go to Phipps, we'd go to the museum, and there were a lot of great things that you gained from those.
Do you remember, you know, this was surprising to me kind of out of nowhere. I always, you know, I liked radio as a kid a lot, kid. But all of a sudden, I remembered this toy I had as a 5 or 6 year old. And I actually, a lot of Sears catalogs are online now, and Sears sold just about anything.
Yep.
So you can look through a Sears catalog and probably find that exact toy. And it was a little, this is so anticlimactic now as I describe it, but it was a little toy radio broadcasting set.
Really?
And
whoa.
It had a little push-to-talk microphone, and it hooked up to a little speaker. I had totally forgotten of the existence of that thing. And, you know, I said, wow, like, that was very, you know, clearly as a very young guy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just amazing to think of. And these little things... one thing I've noticed as I get older is different memories come streaming out of my head. You know,
yeah, you never know.
As we're making space for new memories, some come, you know, ker-chunking out, and that was one of them.
Well, this is interesting you bring that up because I haven't thought about this. I found a musical instrument as a kid. I can't even remember where I found it, and I never know what happened to it. But if you can imagine, it was set up like a thumb piano, except it had a huge rubber band with little – Nibby sticking out with a crank, and when you would turn it, it would play Turkey in the Straw.
My aunt had one of those.
So I'm not imagining this.
Is that a hurdy-gurdy?
I thought a hurdy-gurdy had to have strings.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But this was like, it was...
Plink, plink,
was
plink,
like,
yeah. Yeah.
And to this day, it's one of my favorite tunes because what I would do is I could play it backwards, I could play it forward, I could play it fast, I could play it slow, and it's it's like... that's funny. I hadn't thought. It seems like somehow I found it in our basement, and then I don't know whatever happened to it. It seems like something that I should have held on to forever because I had hours and hours of fun, you know, playing on that thing. Because I grew up in the Mon Valley, and, you know, we pretty much – I lived in a little town called New Eagle, and we could walk to Monongahela where there was a theater. There was a hardware store. And so, you know, in the summer, in those days, yeah, six of us would take off and we'd have a day, you know, just go see this. Go. And there was a place called O'Deli's that had roasted peanuts. And they had the roaster outside the doorway. And what's interesting is only after my mother passed away, I talked to a cousin. It turned out I was related to O'Deli.
Wow.
My father's side of the family were O'Deli's, but changed their name to Odell so that they could get work in the mines. So they told.
So they became Irish rather than Italian, I guess.
Yes, because the Irish at that point were in charge of the mines.
Huh.
So they made themselves Irish. And it's so funny because, you know, then I find out that this whole side of the family who made pasta and said they were Irish were really Italian and came from the Seven Lakes region in northern Italy. And it's just funny because then my father's side of the family, you know, there was no denial. This is what, you know, and it was like, so it's funny because the immigrant experience is really different for everybody. My father's side of the family escaped fascism and he had his 14th birthday on Ellis Island. So everybody has a different story, and with all this immigration thing going on, it's like how this is a country of immigration,
yeah,
and that's how we all got here.
Yeah, one of the things we do a project, and we're in the midst of it right now. We do it in collaboration with Winchester Thurston School, and 30 fifth graders. So these kids are about 10. They team up into groups of three. And we connect them with somebody born in another country who now lives in the Pittsburgh area.
Wow.
And they have ranged from a 93-year-old Holocaust survivor from Austria to a grad student, you know, that just has come over. And the kids prepare. They get a sense of the questions they want to ask. And we end up creating narrationless profiles of these individuals.
Wow.
We've done this 7 times now. So we've done 70 different people, and they're fascinating. And
that's so great to do with young people, because the trouble is when you're young, you don't realize the road that people have traveled. It's sort of a hard concept to imagine.
And you're good at asking questions. You're pretty fearless in asking questions. And I think you're also a really good muse for the person who is telling you about his or her life. Because think about it. If your son wanted to capture your life story, or if somebody you'd never met before wanted to capture your life story, you would probably – I mean, you're a very open guy, but you would probably be a little more expansive, I think, with the stranger because you don't have to worry about repeating yourself. You don't have to worry about maybe saying something that – your story straight. You could be – I mean, you're very open, so it's not
– No. I think you have a really good point. And it's also – there's something about having a young person sort of ask you questions. It sort of makes you feel important.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And it's sort of like, well, yeah. And you want to impart these lessons that you've picked up along the way, because we all pick them up, you know. And just even if you – could just share it just for the idea that this, you know, this is information that you might want to carry with you to help you through the course of a lifetime. But the wonderful thing about coming down here, always what I like, is when you come to the Children's Museum, there's all these kids streaming in. And I came in, a good friend of mine made the giant bird up there, Tim Cullen.
Tim Cullen, great guy.
And I wish he could have been there. And these kids went, wow, oh, that's so cool. Look at that, look at that. And it's like I was about to say, well, a friend of mine did that. But I was like, no. Just, you know, enjoy what you see there. And I can't wait to tell Tim that, you know.
Oh, it's amazing. If you've never seen it, by the way, what's your name again, Steve?
Just don't call me late for dinner.
This is Steve Pellegrino, by the way, and you're listening to the Saturday Light Brigade. Steve, this isn't a case where he and I are chattering because we like talking so much, which we do, and therefore he is not playing music. Steve's actually recovering from rotator cuff surgery, so his instrument is his mouth today and my ears. But anyway, thank you. You're listening to the Saturday Light Brigade. Tim has made this crane, and it's made out of recycled luminescent signs.
Like and, from gas stations.
Yeah, gas stations. So imagine, you know, these BP is not one of them. I know there's a Sunoco.
Esso.
An Esso. And it's a beautiful crane.
It's huge.
And it's huge. It's maybe, 15, 20 feet tall. And kids just go nuts when they see that. The other thing you'll notice when you come in here with kids is you also, you know, they're all excited, but something very special happens to you when you come into the Children's Museum. You become invisible. You are invisible. Kids will walk right into you.
I never even thought of that because they are so
– they're so enthralled with what's going on around them. It's
wow,
like
– that's too much. That's great. It's sort of nice being invisible.
Yeah, it's like a superpower. So just to take a short little break, I've got CDs here to play from, but I'm going to play – a song you did here in the studio.
Oh, okay.
Back. We'll play maybe some CDs too, but this is this is from 2010.
Wow.
And I love it. It's everything you do is special, but this is a great labor song. Some throat singing, you might remember.
Oh, yeah, wow.
So let's take a listen, and then we'll talk some more with Steve here at the Saturday Light Brigade.
Ho, 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 ho. For whom the bell tolls, but not for Joseph Shea. The bell that had stole his life and left him dead that day. He dug his way through slate, cursing his daily tonnage, never knowing where his forward course would lead. Joseph Shea, for all is quiet now, the bell it just collapsed. Now layers of sediment cover his mangled body, a shining pile of black gold. The straw bosses made their wage. For whom the bell tolls, but not for Joseph Shea. The bell that had stole his life and left him dead that day.
That's Steve Pellegrino here at the Saturday Light Brigade. I love that song. Where did that song come from?
True story. My wife's father was the youngest in a family of six. They lived in Scranton, which was a big mining town. And he was 3 years old and came out on the front porch one day to find his father's body.
Oh.
And the mines, when you were killed in an accident, they were nice enough to drag the body to the front porch.
Oh, my gosh.
So there his mother was with six kids. And she had there's no money. There was no Social Security. There was no wage. There was nothing. And so she managed to hold the family together and open a little store. They had a cow and they had chickens, and she raised them. And her our father stayed with us for about 10 years because he, after his wife died, we brought him here, and he had Parkinson's. And so we took care of him for 10 years. And that was his story. The interesting part about it is in the song, it talks about the bell. And I try to take the idea of, you know, for whom the bell tolls.
Mm-hmm.
And in mines, the bell collapsed. And what that means is when you go through a vein of coal and you're digging, every once in a while, the coal is not solid and a hole 3-4 tons come down, and that's what killed him.
So a part you did not brace that you expected to be
okay
caves in.
And it has a bell shape. So it's for whom the bell tolls.
That makes perfect sense. The bell, I never thought about that. It's a great...
Well, I love idiomatic expressions that are connected to jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I have always too. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that, well, you know, like I worked in the mill and shooting the monkey. This is a real, this is, I think.
This is in a steel mill?
This is in the steel mill.
I didn't know this one.
I worked on that furnace that's in Rankin. I was second helper on, and it was number 7.
The Cary furnace.
Yeah.
Okay.
There were 5 or 6 furnaces
shooting
there.
Shooting a monkey.
So let me just quickly explain what this was about. When you make steel, you mix coke, which is baked coal, with iron ore and limestone, and you put it in a huge mixture in this, in a volcanic.
I think limestone, by the way, has been the theme. Maybe that's the string of your whole life.
Limestone is a very important commodity in this because it brings out the impurities out of the,
yeah,
and it floats to the top.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. No.
It's all right. I can digress.
I know.
I'm on a roll with this monkey thing because I don't know why it's called Shoot the Monkey, but basically what happens is because it floats to the top, the second helper goes around the back, they open this hole, and the molten slag comes flying out, which is the impurities, and it's taken in those ladles that everybody sees that look like pots. Those were the cinder ladles. And then the second helper, while this is spewing out, has a 10-foot or 12-foot metal pole, and they have to pour it into ingots so that the lab can then test to see if the impurities are correct. And that's called Shooting the Monkey.
I can't read it, but I just brought up a... I can't read it because the print is too small, but... There's a monkey steel making is the
oh wow,
and they, oh gosh,
yeah, it is pretty rough to read.
It's a tiny. Isn't this great radio, by the way? Are you enjoying listening to me do it's talked about the Bessemer process of steel making. Maybe if you know the any details about this, you can call us 412-200-5975, but there's showed up on Google there from a quick search.
Oh, really? Wow.
It brought up an ancient book that was digitized that we would have to look at very carefully.
So what's an idiomatic expression that you have in the studio?
That's a good question, because I love those too. The first one that came to my head is, you know, pots and pans. Pots are the faders, right?
Right.
And these days, they are no longer potentiometers. A potentiometer, Steve knows this, but is a variable resistor, which basically is a dimmer switch.
Right.
And
right, yeah.
In the olden days, a potentiometer, or pot for short, is how you would increase the volume of something. By decreasing the resistance, something would get louder. And a pan, I guess it's short for panoramic. I never thought about that.
Wow.
But
yeah,
a pan is what you use to make something go to the left channel or to the right channel. So pots and pans are your fader, your control for panning, and the pot is your control.
Wow, I never thought of that with the pan, panoramic.
Oh, you know what another good one is? Is the expression tails out. Now, do you know what that means?
No, no. Okay. What's that one?
Man, I haven't thought about this in years. And it doesn't get used much. I still call things pots just because I think that's what they should be called.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
But Tails Out referred to a reel of tape that was played. Oh, gosh. How did it go? It was basically stored on the – you played it once, and it was rewound all the way on the take-up reel. And that reel was Tails Out, meaning if you wanted to play it again, you would need to rewind it and then play it again.
All right. I do remember that. This is very interesting. I did a show one time. This is really cool. I was doing a show, and I wanted to tape this piece that would go behind some dancers. And, you know, when you're younger and you don't have a lot of money, somebody says, well, I have an old reel, because this was all reel to reel, and it was a quarter
yeah,
track.
Yeah.
So he says, just take the tape and you can have it. You know, I don't care what's on it. Well, I recorded the whole thing, but in the theater, it was a half track.
Yeah.
So when it got played back, everything on one of the quarter tracks played back. So I'm on stage and I hear this going on because we never tried it. So it was this incredible thing. And it ended up being a Robert Ashley piece, who's a famous experimental music person, that was coming through underneath what I had recorded.
Oh, that's bizarre.
So it was called He Was a Visitor. And it was very interesting because it was so close to what I had recorded in terms of concept. It was too much. And I still have that tape, but, you know, it's to find a reel-to-reel tape recorder now, it's sort of like trying to find a Victrola.
That's pretty hard. And if you do find one, it's usually way out of calibration.
Yeah.
There were people, so many people over the years that would say, and now the next program is called Tails Out. They thought that was the name of it. They'd see a tape labeled that way, and they thought that was the name of it.
That's funny.
And
I
then
do
you would
remember,
play, you know, it would be all backwards.
I do remember always having to try to remember to rewind that reel to reel because,
And I think the notion was, you know, rewind it as few times as possible, so you might as well leave it as it was, and then if you're going to play it again,
who wants to stretch all that tape and, you know, mess it all up because, you know, after a few 20, 30 times, everything's in a different key.
Now, are there – there've got to be terms for plastering.
There's in old-time plaster over top of wood lath or metal lath, you'd have what you would call the scratch coat. And this is very interesting because you do the scratch coat, but then you have a tool called the scarifier. And it looks like a thumb piano. It's a little metal, it has a metal handle, and has like 12 little thumb piano things.
And it's definitely onomatopoetic from what you're telling me here.
Yeah. And so what you have to do is you have to make lines in the raw plaster so that when you do the next coat, which is called the brown coat, it has a physical as well as a chemical bond.
Huh.
And then you have the skim coat, which is, you know, the top coat, which you end up painting. And many people in Pittsburgh will know about this. Anytime you get in your old house, you say, what is all that stuff that's on top of the plaster? Well, that's sanitas. Because back in the day when you did a whole house of plaster over wood lath, you were not able to paint for 6 months. Because the moisture, there was so much moisture in the walls that if you painted, because in those days it was all oil-based, it would peel off.
Huh.
So what they invented was a thing called Sanitas, which is a cloth wallpaper. And they would glue that on. And what's
that was in our house. That's why all the painters were mad at us.
Yes. But if you're lucky and everything's in good shape, you can pull all that off and you have raw plaster.
Is it like yellowy?
Yeah.
When we had all the wallpaper taken down in our house and it was there. Actually, the date was – somebody wrote a date that they had installed it and it was from the 60s. And, you know, we had hired some painters to remove the wallpaper and repaint it. And they were – they grossly underestimated how hard it was to remove the wallpaper, and it was because the folks papered over that Sanitas layer, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And then probably there was 10 coats of paint over top of the Sanitas.
Yeah.
And no, wallpaper, that's a chore. But, you know, and then, you know, this, like, you know, when you're talking about plaster, you know, is it going to be a dry mix, a wet mix? That's pretty self-explanatory. But another term, spiking a mix. If you want the plaster to go faster, to dry faster, you can throw extra lime in, and that spikes the mix, and it causes it to dry quicker.
That would get really hot, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I had the opportunity to experience lime in my eye. It was an axe. I was plastering, and I stood on a bathtub, and in my youth, as a crazy man trying to get it done quickly, fell. And when I did, the lime got in my eye. And one of the problems with lime is it's not an acid, it's a base. So it, when it burns your eye, the scar tissue tends to cover over your lens. And I was lucky that I caught it fast enough. And it's interesting when you get around a bunch of plasters, it's like their big question is, when'd you get your first splash? I didn't get a splash. I got a tooth tsunami.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's an interesting trade, too, plastering, because it's getting harder and harder to find the supplies.
I know. Why? I only know two guys that do it, you and one other. I mean, it's getting hard to find people that really know how to do plaster.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's not something you can learn overnight, and it's really not something you do to just make a buck. You have to somehow be nuts enough to like it. I love it. And one of the things about me not being able to work right now is when I go by a construction site, I start to salivate. I just like to do.
But you were mentioning supplies, so if you needed a scarifier, you might be looking for somebody else's scarifier, or
there's a place in Wilkinsburg called Mead Products that still sells plaster play things, and I think there's a place in Carnegie. We have the internet now, and it's insane the things that you can find on the internet. There's, and you know, in just the 41 years that I've done plaster, there's so many things that don't exist anymore. I'm sure you're familiar with metal lath, that diamond-shaped pulled metal.
Yeah.
Well, they used to have a rib lath. They used to have all kinds of different kinds of lath, different sizes. And because everything's gone towards drywall now, it's very difficult to find a lot of these products. And there's even lumber yards don't even carry. You have to almost go to a plaster supply house to get these. I have a friend that lives in Cleveland, and you cannot even buy any kind of plaster product.
Wow.
So
I just thought of another one for you. Yeah. In radio, at least in terms of equipment, buses. Buses are basically denotes the channel or the route that sound is going to take. Right now, our radio program has a bus that carries it to the internet. There's a bus that carries it to some of our stations. There's a bus that carries it to another station.
Wow.
And it's just like, you know, when I teach kids or adults for that matter, I say it's a bus. That's because bus. What do buses do? They pick up things and they take them to another place. But I think it comes from like an electrical bus, too. I think there's a term.
It sounds familiar, and I can't place it myself. I just realized something. I worked in radio for a short time. I had a good friend who was Perry Marshall's on-air producer.
That's so funny because Dan Kamen was here early this morning.
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking about Perry Marshall, who was on overnight from midnight to 6 or so at KDK for a long time.
Yeah, and so I worked the weekend shift with him. Really interesting guy. I mean, I just remember him telling me he grew up in Chicago, and so, of course, he was old enough to have seen vaudeville. And, you know, you get to hear these great stories about who's the great singer, Mammy, How I Love You, How? I can't remember his name. Al Jolson.
Thank you.
He said he was at a show with Al Jolson. He put on like a 3-hour show and, you know, didn't stop. You know, he wasn't drinking water. He just kept. And when he was done, he said, "You ain't seen nothing yet," and went on for another hour. So, and it's like, you know, and this is the sad part about getting old. You run out of old people to go hear these stories about, because when you're younger, you don't take for granted that they'll always be there, that these great stories. And this is what's great about this program you're doing with these fifth grade kids. I mean, can you imagine to talk to somebody who actually experienced, you know, being in a concentration camp at a time in history that's so unbelievable that you sometimes don't even want to think about it?
Yeah, that story. And by the way, it's on neighborhoodvoices.org. If you search on Carla Stept, who unfortunately has since passed away. But her story, she is so lucid and vivid in her description. And not just, she actually escaped. So what she's describing is the times and just how she ended up coming to the United States. It's really something to listen to.
Wow. Now, how do you come up with an idea like that? How do you say this would be a great idea? Because, I mean, it is, but what, you know, do you see something and it causes you to think about this and you travel through this? I love the process of how people come up with ideas.
That one, I mean, I remember it really. I often don't remember it clearly, but this one I happen to is we were talking with a woman. She's a librarian. She also teaches about a way to bring every fifth grader learns about immigration as part of Pennsylvania's standards, academic standards. There's a unit on immigration. And she really wanted to bring it to life because she recognized that it was being taught in a very dry kind of, you know, here are the statistics, this is where people came from. And it just kind of hit me. I said, well, why don't we have kids talk to people born in other countries who live here? And I didn't want to use the word immigrant because I don't really like to noun people necessarily.
No, I think these
are people born in other countries who now live in Pittsburgh. And it's amazing what these kids have to say. And if you give a kid the assignment, or an adult for that matter, okay, you're a reporter or you're an interviewer, and it's your job to get a complete profile of this person and to present it, it kind of liberates you from the fear of asking a question that might you might think is a dumb question, or because suddenly you've got a job to do. So you're engaged. You know, it's my job to get you to talk about your life. And so the kids, they almost forget that they're doing work.
Well, no, because then it's not work. The goal causes them – because, you know, it's so funny. I just think about all the older people. Like when I was around 8 or 10, we had a neighbor who was retired. He was an engineer on a train. And I'd love to go talk to him because there's this place near El Rama along the Mon River. It's called Shire Oaks. And it used to be this huge railroad center. And then it kind of like disappeared. And now it's reappeared. Like the railroad has become more important because of, you know, fuel, et cetera, because it's so efficient use of, you know, hauling freight. And one of the great things would be he would always offer to take us berry picking in the summer. And I remember we would all take our buckets, get up very early in the morning, and he would take us way deep into the woods, and we'd get buckets and buckets of these berries. And then I would bring them home, and my grandmother would tell everybody, if you give me – I will make pies out of all these berries if you let me have one pie for every one pie I make for you. Everybody made out, and everybody got a pie. But it was very interesting to be able to, as a kid, be able to interact in your neighborhood with older people.
Yeah.
And it seems nowadays it's really hard to see it. You don't see that.
Many neighborhoods are more homogeneous, I think, than they once were. You know, we live in Avalon, Bellevue, which thankfully is all over the place.
Well, that's great.
Age-wise, I grew up in Churchill Borough, which at the time was pretty much all, you know, adults my parents' age and kids around our ages. Hey, I just noticed a message we got from Mark. I'm not sure where Mark's writing from, but he mentioned an expression, rabbits running.
Oh, and, what's that?
And rabbits running is a strip mining expression for explosives going off in series.
Wow. And
thank you, Mark.
And, well, that's a good one.
Also, Susan, thank you for your note. I did get that. She was mentioning sort of poetry and expression about immigration. There have been so many great songs and great stories about immigration. There's so many expressions. I do love flavor expressions. Here's something for you. And I've got to be careful because we're getting close to the top of the hour. We had a gentleman I forget the restaurant he worked for, Ricky. He used to call us all the time. John from Mercer, who worked for a national restaurant chain. It might have been IHOP. I can't remember the one. But when the cook made their orders, they put the toast and the jelly in clock positions on the plate, and it was a code to know who got scrambled eggs, who got bacon, who got sausage, because everybody got, you know, toast and jelly.
Yeah.
And the clock, you know, is the toast at 12 o'clock? It's scrambled eggs. Is the toast at 3?
Wow, that's now that. That's thinking.
It was really elaborate, and to hear him describe it was just amazing. So how soon do you think you're going to be able to play again?
Well, they say I'll be able to do light duty at 8 months, and I was operated in November. So I am able to play scales on the piano, but they want me to take it easy because, you know, they want this to heal.
So light duty... So you're off work for another 7 months. Six months. Oh, man.
I'm sure my wife will begin to find wonderful things to do around the house.
Well, they have to be below your waist.
Well, hopefully I'm starting to the exercise I'm doing now are starting to, you know, over my head. It's just I can't do things that would cause a jerk or like I can't pick up a gallon of milk at the present time, but I am able to tie my own shoes and brush my teeth, and I can take a shower by myself.
And string together wonderful stories.
Well, it's always great being here, Larry, and I tell you, you just cannot underestimate how wonderful this show is.
Oh.
I'm telling you, man, you're the guy.